Welcome to Burr News Current Affairs Podcast with Jeremy Deacon. Listen at your leisure on www.burrnews.com.
Good morning and welcome to this, the latest edition of our live Burr News Facebook interviews. Joined today by John Barrett. Mr. Barrett doesn't really need any introduction, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Looking forward to this. There's been an awful lot happening in the last few months, but one of the most notable things that has happened that you've been directly involved in is the Commission of Inquiry. Things have settled down a bit now. You've issued your report some months ago. How has it been received? What kind of feedback have you had over that?
Well, from my point of view, surprisingly, I didn't think it had as much impact as I think we had hoped it would have. I have to say that in all honesty.
What do you mean by that?
Well, let's back up when the report was presented. I thought, and now I'm not going to presume to speak for the other commissioners when I say this. The commission is now functus, no longer existing, so I'm speaking for myself. I thought that when the report was handed over to the Premier, that it would be tabled in the House of Assembly. And not only that it would be tabled, but that it would be tabled for debate. And that, as you know, never happened. Not in a formal sense.
No, there was a committee, cabinet committee, wasn't there?
Well, that's something completely different. Right. And I want to make a point here when I say that, because it dovetails nicely with my own views on governance and good governance in Bermuda.
Talk about commission first.
It's not that you just wanted to see, or I wanted to see, the report debated. But, you know, there were some 50 recommendations in here, not all of which were new. Some of them were following on from the SAGE Commission and recommendations other people and bodies had made. I thought that it would have been a great opportunity not only to table the report for debate, but to strike a joint select committee which could oversee the implementation, adoption, rejection of the recommendations in the report. And I say that because it's important, in my view, to involve the legislature, because it is comprised of members of both parties. One party which aspires to be the government, and the other party which is the government. Governments change over the years. This happens. Mm. We know it.
It's going to change soon.
So do members of each party and those who comprise the government. It is important, in my view, that something like this, which is talking about reform of the administration of government, that it become the subject of oversight by members of both parties, that this is something that could be outside or above the usual cut and thrust of political debate.
Is it too late?
No, because now we're in election interrupters, yes. If I can put it that way, which I think is probably put this on the shelf as well, as people now concentrate, when I say, well, I guess the general public, but the parties in particular, concentrating on winning the next election. And so this is put to one side. So no, it's not too late, but I'm just saying that when it was tabled, at that time there was no thought, I don't think, at least in the general public, that we were facing an imminent election.
No.
And sometimes it's important, I think, to strike the right note when you present things to the legislature, because in presenting it, you give your vision, your commitment as to how you think this ought to operate.
So you talk about striking the right note by not tabling it in the House, at least so far. What does that say in your opinion?
Well, I don't know what to make of it, because I didn't understand why it wasn't done the formal way. And instead, what was struck was a cabinet committee. Mm. And it may be that the Premier and the cabinet and the government of the day wanted to, as it were, take it out of the public debate to allow themselves an opportunity to work through the report, because it wasn't, I wouldn't say it's voluminous, but there was a lot in there, and to work through the recommendations, and then to pick through what they think they could do and they could not do. And maybe they were going to come back to the House. But from my point of view, it's important right from the outset, and that's where we go so wrong in this country. It's one of the things I've been outspoken about when I was a member of the opposition, when I was in the House, and now that I've been outside the House, that we have to put in place these vehicles which, I don't want to use the word force, but require members on both sides to work through, because one day you could be the opposition and the other party could be the government and vice versa. And it's important to create opportunities for that type of continuity.
Well, to come on to your opinions on good governance later on, but you did mention the Joint Select Committee. Now, there isn't a history of many Joint Select Committees in the House of Assembly, is there? So, I mean, what are the chances, do you think, of a report like this being considered by a Joint Select Committee, let alone by the House?
I can tell you this as a general principle. If no one does anything, nothing will happen.
Yes.
So you've got to start somewhere. For the many years that I was in opposition under Progressive Labour Party government, I used to press, and indeed it became part of the manifesto of the One Bermuda Alliance, which I helped found, that we would reform the system of government to change things. And one of the things that was in the platform was to have a network of committees. Mm. SAGE, in fact, the SAGE Commission, recommended. I thought it was a very good suggestion. Look, you have three committees comprised of backbenchers, and backbenchers include both opposition and government, mm-hmm. who will take groupings of ministries and monitor them and be involved in policy decisions if they need to, admit the public in to make representations, and to track the expenditure of money. And the argument you hear sometimes, well, there's only so many members in the House of Assembly. Well, goodness gracious, do the arithmetic. You take 12 out of the cabinet, take away the speaker, that's 13 from 36, leaves 23 backbenchers. And then you have 11 in the Senate, take away two ministers, that's 9. You've got 32. From them, I'm pretty sure you could have three committees of 5, in addition to the most important committee in the House, the Public Accounts Committee, which is a select committee. It ought to become joint select and admit senators. But in any event, these are important vehicles for people to do work. So you get away from the House just being the game of throats where you give speeches, and you start moving to where people get an opportunity to sit around a table, roll up their sleeves, and do work. And it ought to be put in place so that members of government are not to be viewed in any way as treasonous to the party should they perform biting oversight. And it gives them an opportunity in any event to show their mettle should they be interested in a particular portfolio, should they aspire to the cabinet. And the same is true for opposition members, mm-hmm. of course, who want to become exactly. government. Mm-hmm. And to my way of thinking, somebody's got to move off on this. And the longer we delay it, in my view, the worse things get.
Let's come back onto that, because it is a subject I want to go into more detail with you on. But coming back to the Commission of Inquiry, given the fact that it hasn't been tabled in the House, given the fact that a Cabinet Committee has made some recommendations, given the fact there isn't a Joint Select Committee on it, is it going to be a waste of time?
I'd like to think not. But I mean, all that work, all that time, all that money gone to waste, it's a real possibility, no question about it.
Is that your concern, that it's a possibility?
Well, yeah, of course it's a concern, but I like to think I did my job, and we completed the report. It took us longer than we thought. The scope was a little wider, and the work was a little harder than we thought, certainly than I imagined, I can tell you that. And the logistics of four people, you know, not only researching themselves, but then writing a report and getting it right, was important, our view, to get everything right, was no easy task. So yes, particularly with respect to the recommendations, and I'm talking about the recommendations, this is a thing that interested me particularly when I accepted the job, was how we could reform government and make it a finer-tuned instrument. And that's something for the present and for the future. And with respect to the other recommendations, with respect to quote-unquote evidence of criminal activity, as we said in the report, and I don't think I'm saying anything new here, we found that most of the items that we looked at were already under criminal investigation.
You mentioned some of the recommendations. There were some fairly fundamental ones. The Office of Project Management and Procurement to give financial oversight. the lack of statutory effect of financial instructions, etc. I could go on, I'm not going to, but to me those are some of the most fundamental ones. And then about 3 weeks ago, I think it was.
I have one more to it, the Code of Conduct for Ministers.
I had actually written that down, the Ministerial Code of Conduct, which was actually published in April 2015, and then provision for to be made statutory was dropped, wasn't it?
I don't know if it was ever going to be made statutory, but if you'll allow me to comment, you've raised these things. One of the things, and I'll just say this by way of prefacing my remarks, I used to joke when I moved into the opposition that that side of the House seemed to have a better view because I'm starting to see things more clearly than when you're in the government. And there's a certain truth to that without sounding overly critical of the government. And now that I'm outside the House of Assembly, I see things even clearer. And that's the way I put it. And with respect to those items that you just mentioned, one of the things that I was able to see in the clear light of day, with as objective a mind as I could bring to the process and as fair as possible as I could be, is that a lot of the items that you mentioned were ones that were being tackled prior to the departure of the PLP government and Premier Paula Cox at the last election.
Your report did note the word
yes,
Paula Cox.
And that's important to say that, because it did appear that this problem was not being totally ignored, that the challenges, I should say the problem, that some of the problems and the challenges were not being totally ignored. And we tried to give credit to the Progressive Labour Party for starting to move on things like establishing an Office of Procurement and Project Management, developing and putting in place legislation so that financial instructions could then have the force of law, so that that simply means, for people to understand, is that people could be prosecuted for failing to follow, and not just disciplined and or surcharged. We found out that that's rarely been exercised. Surcharge means docking somebody their pay for a big mistake. And then the other item was the revision of the Code of Conduct for Ministers. And what's important about that was that the Progressive Labour Party were proposing to change it to make it, what's the word I want to look for here, to change the culture so that civil servants and ministers would feel it appropriate where they were making a decision that the civil servant thought was contrary to financial instructions or practice. There was a procedure in place as to how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing of all, I think. You know, Cabinet can make a decision, and they can override, if they like, financial instructions at their peril. But the civil servant needs to, and that needs to be documented so that there's a paper trail the Auditor General who comes later, so we can see exactly what was done and why.
I believe it was actually that was dropped in the last, in the rewrite of the Code of Conduct.
That was, to our amazement, the Sage Commission commented on this and said, we like this revision, it ought to be adopted forthwith. It not only was it not adopted, but that whole provision was almost excised from the Code of Conduct, which struck us as wrong.
I mentioned some of the recommendations. I did start saying that 3 weeks ago the Premier did have a press conference where he announced some progress on the Commission of Inquiry's report. You presumably watched that. You presumably noted the recommendations.
Yes, of course.
Did they go far enough? Were there enough of them?
I think it was a start. In my view, it was the low-hanging fruit.
That's good, because there was no mention of the Office of Procurement, mention of financial... Well, there was a mention of financial instructions, but we're going to look at it later.
It was the low-hanging fruit, in my view, and it was stuff that I've just commented on that actually probably, arguably, should have been tackled when the new government came in, because it would have been there on the table. I mean, a code of practice for the civil service when it comes to procurement and project management. I don't know why it would take 4 years to get that off the ground. And we found out, and I cannot remember the actual number, but it was in its 20th draft or something. And so, you know, at some point, somebody's got to move off on it. Now, we understood and learned that it was being used, but these things need to be formalized if you're going to change the culture. If you want people to take it seriously, you yourself have to take it seriously and move. Similarly with financial instructions. That had been on the table for some time. Making it law, the ability was there. Still hasn't been done. That apparently is still under active review.
We will review financial instructions.
The Code of Ministers.
The Civil Service Code of Conduct and Conditions of Employment. That was announced at the press conference.
But again, that's with respect, I find that to be pretty straightforward and, as you say, fundamental.
So what is it then? Is it just a lack of willpower?
I conclude sometimes it is a lack of political will. People are perhaps concentrating and focusing on other matters. And to my way of thinking, this is the foundation on which you build, and it's important to get that right.
it's a relatively dry subject, but to me it's, and please correct me if I'm wrong because this is my supposition, to me it's a question about gatekeeping, and you're leaving the gate open for other things to happen.
Well, yeah, I call it the stable door, and it's important to have the right stable so that people know how the system is meant to work. When the horse is long since bolted, it's of little practical value.
So coming back, with the Cabinet Committee's reported, and there were 10 recommendations that the Premier said they were following up on. Coming back to my original question and your original statement about the Joint Select Committee tabling in the House, what would you like to see next?
I'd like to see that. I really would like to see an attempt, a bipartisan attempt to oversee this, because in some respects, the civil service are the ones who have to implement
this.
It's
their guidelines, isn't it?
And to make it work, and someone's got to oversee them. And why make it just a cabinet minister or the cabinet? Make it the legislature. That's what the legislature is there for. That's why we have representatives. That's why we end up with backbenchers. And that's, in my estimation, that's their job.
That's the other thing, you talked about the legislature. I was actually at this press conference, and I did ask whether these recommendations are going to be policy or legislation, and they are going to be policy. Do you think a lot of this should be legislated for? You mentioned financial instructions, but other things should be legislated for, so it's black and white. You break the law, you break the law.
Well,
policy is always...
Well, financial instructions are the most important thing. There are policies as to how things can be interpreted and how they can be applied. And as I said to you earlier, government is elected to govern, and cabinet can govern. They can make these decisions. I mean, we heard that more than once at our public hearings. Cabinet is supreme. And yours truly, at each occasion, wanted to argue the point, but I was told that now is neither the time nor the place. And the reason I wanted to argue the point is the cabinet is empowered under our Constitution order to make these decisions, these executive decisions that they think are best for the country, and then they get it through their caucus.
That's right. Yep.
And then they bring it to the House for a vote where a vote is required. And that's the way the system works. But it is not meant to stop there. The executive is meant to be subject to checks and balances, and that's where backbenchers come in. So once decisions are made, if the government has made up its mind, then it's their job to monitor and follow and track to make sure it's done, that the money is spent as it should be and is not overspent, and that the right decisions are put in place. And once the civil servants know that that happens and they'll be called to account, the hope is that that will encourage them to make sure that policies and financial instructions in particular are followed to the T. And that way, I think, we'll get more effective, efficient government.
When you made your report, I wrote a column for Bernese on this, and I think the last paragraph I asked a question, which I'm going to ask you. Can the electorate be absolutely confident that the checks and balances needed to safeguard the public purse are going to be in place and be effective and enforceable?
That remains an open question, Jeremy. Until something like this is tackled in an open, transparent way in the legislature where members are making sure that it is done and the public knows what's being rejected and why, and what's being adopted and why, and what's being modified and why, I think until we get that system up and running the way it could and the way it should, I think that will always be an open question, and one in which some people are going to have serious, serious doubts. And that's surely that was the whole point of this exercise.
Well, you told me, was that all?
Well, from my point of view, I'm saying that not as a question, but as a statement. But I understand why some people think it's an open question.
Just moving on, we are in the middle of an election campaign at the moment, but I wanted to take you to step back from it all a little bit. You mentioned you were a founding member of the OBA. Now, that was about 5 years ago now, so you've effectively been out of politics.
Six
years ago? Okay. Yeah, so you've effectively been out of mainstream politics for about 6 years. And you actually mentioned yourself, you must be reading my questions, I think, that you've been looking from the
I haven't acquired that skill over the years to read upside down.
But looking in from the outside for that long, what do you see now? What's your perception of politics now? And the political arena and the way politics is conducted, the style of politics?
Oh, I have I have views, strong views, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to express them here today, and I'll try and do it in a way that is reasonable and not over the top, because there's so much noise today that I think is driven largely by partisan party politics, not just party politics, but by the partisan of party politics, who feel that there's no length to which they cannot go, because the ultimate goal is their party.
It's power.
That's right, wins. And know this about politicians. If the one thing, maybe even the only thing they understand, is power and the loss of power. So thank goodness for elections. That's the first thing, because they're a very corrective factor in politics. If I could just stop and pause, I was away when Sean Crockwell died. And I have to tell you, at the time I didn't believe it. I'm still having difficulty processing his death. But one of the things that he said, and I don't know if it's fair to describe it as a dying wish, but it was something he said, and I wrote it down. He said that it is his hope that we would come together, confront our differences, and figure out a way to work together to solve them. And I have to tell you, that's been my mantra. It was when I sat as a member of the opposition, notwithstanding that I would engage from time to time in partisan politics, but I always tried to temper my remarks so that they would be heard, not just by the general public, but by people on the other side. And Sean is not alone in that wish. I find there is an axis of anxiety out there today amongst people who support or inclined to support OBA or PLP about the way in which we tackle our problems. Bermuda will always have its challenges. And there's no question about that. You can just look at it going forward based on what we've seen in the past. And you have to ask yourself, do we have a system in place? Do we use the system we have in place to maximum advantage in this sense, that it encourages our representatives to work together and not always to be shouting across the aisle at each other or coming up with the best soundbite or spinning the best press release? And this is a point, I won't labor it again, we've touched on it already, as to how it could be done in the House of Assembly, how it should be done. I tell people that there's three examples I can give you right off the top of my head on how things could be done differently and how they could bring about a different result. As you look back on the last four or five years of the current government, with the America's Cup, a great deal of credit is to be given, is deserved to be given, to the One Bermuda Alliance for securing that and here in Bermuda for all the benefit that it brings. But when they struck the organizing committee, and I remember writing a column about this and saying, look, fellas, I think the optics are wrong. I got soundly criticized by some of the people involved. I'm not going to say whether it's fair or unfair. I simply think it was wrong. Mm. Because if you think back to a project that was started by the business community back when Ewart Brown was premier of this country, it was called Bermuda First. Mm-hmm. And when the oversight committee was established, it was established so that the co-chairmen were who? The premier and the leader of the opposition. It tried to involve people right at the top mm-hmm. to send the signal that this is going to be as inclusive as it can be, and we want everybody on board, and then it would filter down from there. I don't think that was done in the case of the America's Cup. It could have been done differently and to send a stronger and better signal to the community, especially given the history of yachting in Bermuda. And why do I say that? I mean, this is beyond the reach, particularly this type of racing, of the average person in Bermuda. We know about sailing, no sailing, but the history has not been one of a broad, inclusive sport in Bermuda. And it could have, things, in my view, could have been different had it been organized differently. And that's just, and that's a positive thing. I don't think that's negative. I just think it's positive. And if people were offered that or granted it and they refused it, then that's on them. Mm-hmm. I grant you that. Then we come to pathways to status. No, anybody with any inkling of the history in Bermuda and a knowledge of immigration in this country would know that that is a potentially explosive issue. And it should have been, in my view, brought forward again on as much a bipartisan basis as possible. And look, after all that happened, what did we end up with? Committees of interested and key stakeholders working through the different possibilities and options. And we had to go through all of what we went through to come to learn that. I have to tell you, I thought, well, there's a clear example of how it could be done better. Then you come on to the airport, and look, everyone's instinct, I think natural instinct with the airport development project would have been this. As the finance minister himself is bold to say from time to time, there is no such thing as a free lunch. There's also another saying to everyone, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. But we were told that this is the best and only way to build a new airport. And it, in my view, it would have been better if there was an attempt right from the outset to involve both parties in oversight in working through the agreement. Now, I know there are some difficulties with that in terms of wanting to keep some certain information, proprietary information, confidential. And if the developer or the person who said that this was, could not be done, fair enough, excise that and give the reasons. And if someone wants to challenge it, it's not done all the time, but it's a regular occurrence. Someone can go to a judge and say, do you agree or not agree with that, if they felt strongly about it? But all the other information, all the other stuff you can work through together with an oversight, whether the Public Accounts Committee tried. They tried to do what, in my estimation, what the Public Accounts ought to be doing, not always preoccupied with Auditor General reports of events that happened 3, 4, 5 years ago, like the Commission of Inquiry. Some of ours work dated back 7 years. Mm-hmm. You want to get current. You want to make sure they have the resources to be current.
Just going back to a couple of things, you mentioned partisan politics, but politics everywhere just about is partisan. I mean, you look at the House of Parliament now; it couldn't be more partisan. Of everything the Conservatives, the DUP, Liberals, Labour are going through, is Bermuda any more partisan than anywhere else?
That comparison is almost one that invites you to excuse what's going on here. And I'm not going to go there because I think we can do better. I really do. I've come to know people on both sides of the fence, parties over the year. And indeed, you can see sometimes that there are shared values, shared thoughts, shared visions among members on both sides of the House. We've got to do all we can to provide vehicles and opportunities for that to find expression. The partisan stuff will always stay there. There's nothing wrong, in my view, with somebody standing their ground on principle or on an issue or what they think is right or wrong, but not at the expense of failing to find any common ground. And you've got to provide a platform for that to happen. And I've always maintained that our system has not, people say, you've got to get rid of the Westminster system. Well, I'm not so sure you need to throw out the baby with the dirty bathwater. I mean, look at some fundamental example. The Senate. People there sit around a table, and they sit when they speak. That's not to say the content of speeches changes, but certainly the tone does. From the House of Assembly. And so you can look, as they do in some territories now, I know Northwest Territories in Canada, their chamber is a horseshoe shape, not across the aisle. There's no requirement that it has to be across the aisle, which lends itself to bun fights. And similarly, there's no reason why the House of Assembly backbenchers can't be better utilized than they are now.
You've touched on that. We'll get on to that a little bit later. You mentioned the America's Cup and you mentioned the airport. If you're sitting there as government, wouldn't you want to take credit for those two very big projects?
But you will,
yourself?
You will get credit. I mean, the America's Cup, we know that they were the ones who came up with the idea and brought it here. How can they be not deny credit for that? But if you really...
The total credit, you know.
Yeah, but, well...
It's a big flag for you, isn't it, to wave?
Yeah, well, if you do it at the expense of excluding others, you can hardly complain at the end when others don't participate or don't feel warm and fuzzy about it. That's my point.
Mm-hmm.
And look, the most important point of all is you talked about England and also what goes on in Washington and the United States. They're slightly bigger countries than Bermuda. We live in 20 square miles. Everybody is your neighbor. I think it behooves us to make a better effort than they do elsewhere.
So what would you change?
Well, I told you, I'd change the way the House of Assembly operates and it's structured to try and give this opportunity for people to work together and so that people get measured not only by their words, but what it is they're able to do around the table.
But that's changing a considerable mindset, isn't it?
Because
the mindset is...
I think you change the culture.
How would you change the culture, though?
By doing this, because it will no longer...
But the culture is very embedded.
Well... But somebody's got to start somewhere, and soon, in my view, and soon. And you'll not, as I said to you earlier, if you do nothing, I guarantee you nothing will change.
Yeah, I know. You say someone's going to do it. Who?
The
Who can lead?
The government always is the one that has to do it. I'll go back to another thing you mentioned earlier about the Premier, after he read through the report, he said, well, with respect to campaign finance, but a recommendation on that, that's a matter for the legislature. Well... Arguably, it is, no question, but governments often lead, though, and take stuff to the legislature. But they had a joint select committee very early on in this parliament, which made recommendations about the Parliamentary Election Act, on which members from both sides agreed. I mean, there was some disagreement, but there was a lot of agreement. As far as I could tell, nothing came of that.
Was that Cole Simons?
No, that was Walton Brown. Cole Simons was another one about... how to change the management structure of the House of Assembly, which goes part the way to what I've been talking about.
Which is 2014, was it?
And nothing has come of that. These things fall away as priorities. And I suspect you would hear that the first response is, well, we've got a limited number of members and we've got other options, other things we have to deal with, other priorities, particularly the economy. And, you know, as... One member used to say, Alex Scott used to say, I used to remember saying, you know, when you're in government, you've got to learn to chew gum and walk at the same time. If you ran on a platform, I know this sounds like I'm picking on the OBA, but they are the government, and I had a hand in drafting that platform, where you're going to reform the system and change it, then that's one of the things you get on with, in my view, as soon as you go in. You put it in train. And one example, and I suspect that there are some people out there quite angry, students, although there'll be the elections in the summer, we still have no absentee ballot.
Isn't it the case that sometimes the status quo suits the government, though? I mean, it's like, you know, every member opposition party wants proportional representation until they're in power.
Yeah, it's fair to draw that conclusion. I think it's a fair observation, yeah. That once in, and you know, the Progressive Labour Party in his throne speech back in November, David Burke wrote something that I could have written myself in terms of what they intend to do once they're government. The question is that people ask themselves: will they do it? And if they are elected government, who's going to hold them to account to make sure it does happen? But that's. The system. That's the way.
That's
the way we work. And you get 5 years later to throw people out if you think they haven't kept their promises, if they're important to you.
By which time, very often they're forgotten about. A week is a long time in politics.
Yeah, politics is a game of broad strokes. There's no question about that. When people look back over 5 years,
July the 18th, we have got an election. Looking at it from the outside, which party do you think at the moment is best equipped to govern? Not that I'm putting you on the spot.
You are putting me on the spot. I think there are members on both sides who are equipped to
So neither party is equipped, but members on both sides are.
Well, that's a point I'm trying to make always, that you know, to think that it resides in one party on one side, although people will have to make a choice, obviously, when they go to vote, is wrong-headed. We ought to be looking more... that who are the best members to elect?
But we don't operate in that system. We have a two-party system.
No, no, but you get a vote. You get to vote on a member. You don't vote. You don't have to vote strictly party when you vote.
No, but you do know, most people have a sense that
because
you get to the partisan politics, which goes back to where we were talking before, you are consumed by the party.
And normally what you hear is better the devil I know than the devil I don't, which is not a very good commendation.
So which party is best equipped to govern? Or will be best equipped to govern?
I'm not going to engage on that one.
Will you like to pontificate about who might win?
No, I don't want to do that either, because I have a sense that it's going to be close. It's going to be close.
Another column I wrote for Burn News was last week, and it was on the question of will there be a rise of the independents. I guess it's a question that everybody talks about every election cycle. Thad Hollis declared earlier this week. Just first of all, what's your opinion on that? He's a bit of a political heavyweight, former chairman of the OBA. Do you think he might score some success against Wayne Ferbert?
I think it depends on how you measure success. If you mean
will he be elected?
Will he win? I think it's a tough road to hoe, but Thad, there's a lot about him and his candidacy that may appeal to voters, but he's up against someone who has won there both as United Bermuda Party and then as Progressive Labour Party. So here's a fellow whose popularity transcends politics. But I do understand there are a number of people who've been talking about running as independents. And I understand, indeed I've been approached. Get that on the table right now, and I've been considering it.
You've been approached to run as an independent?
Oh, yeah.
Or to run for a party?
No, to run as an independent. That was encouraged to do that, because people feel that an independent may start to modify and help modify a lot of the partisan party politics that are engaged here and represent constituents and put country above party instead of doing things that are almost always designed, well, not almost always designed, but a primary consideration is it keeps the party together.
Is that a growing sense that you're getting from that? Because
I think so.
There's been one elected independent MP, that was Stuart Hayward. There's been others who have elected to go independent, but only one elected. Yeah. And the overwhelming view is that while we have two-party politics, a vote for an independent is a waste. Or it's a vote to let somebody else in because he's splitting the vote.
No, that's exactly right, and that's Jeremy.
So you say you've heard about others going independent. Is there a growing movement? Do you sense something building compared to other years?
Yes.
Is it something we hear every election cycle?
If I can put it this way, the clothes are there. They simply have no emperor at the moment. And what I mean by that, there is a feeling that something has to be done, that there needs to be change. But there's a hesitancy, there's a reservation for the reasons you just mentioned about voting for an independent, not knowing what impact that will ultimately have on who is elected, the government party.
Where are you getting this sense from, though?
You
say there's a growing sense that something has to change. Where are you getting
from
that from?
From people I speak to. Whether they're on the street, whether they approach me, or whether I've knocked on their doors to speak to them, because I have been out in my former constituency.
Great constituencies.
Asking people what they think of current policies and about the possibility of myself running as an independent. And I've been out there asking people actively to assess people's moods, to see what they think.
So how could an independent in the House make a difference?
Well, that depends on the numbers, doesn't it? I mean, if it breaks right, they could have a great deal of
influence. Well, you could be kingmakers or queenmakers or whatever. But just on the supposition that one independent member is elected.
Well, if you take Terry Lister as the example, then it's ineffectual, really, because it doesn't change the numbers, it doesn't influence anything. If there are more than one, as it happened in the Cayman Islands, for instance, it has a profound effect.
How?
Well, because neither party succeeded in forming the government.
Yeah.
They relied on the independents. That sends a very strong message to the political parties about what it is they need to do and what change they need to take on board in order to be more effective. And that is the that is part of the point behind an independent candidacy, is the message it sends that, we, you know, and on so many levels. A, you can't take us for granted anymore. That's one of the things I hear. B, I'm more interested in people who are going to represent me as opposed to the party. And B, C, they're going to put Bermuda ahead of what is best for their party. Because there come times where there are decisions that have to be made as to what whether we're here doing what's best for Bermuda or trying to combine what's best for Bermuda and saving face or promoting the party.
Because, of course, an independent is just that. They're not bound by the party whip, so they have a bigger voice in the House, do you think?
Correct. Yeah.
Is there a mood to elect an independent MP?
Don't know. You see, it's an interesting... I was canvassing and sampling opinion before the election was called, and now that it's been called, there's a shift, because people then decide, the question you ask me, who do I... Well, not, you didn't ask this question, but who do I want to form the government? And they start thinking about, well, will my vote by default elect the party I don't want to be in government? And that becomes and I understand that.
And there's tactical voting as well.
Yeah, and before, when you had dual seat constituencies, people could split their vote and feel comfortable doing that, but that's no longer possible. You have to make the stark choice. So it's, and frankly, I'm still assessing what people think. The only thing I would say is that time is against an independent now, because the election's been called, as we know that, and there are only so many days, and if you've got a constituency of 1,000, I can tell you, it does take some effort to visit, if you're going to, all of those people and explain to them, first, who you are, B, why you're running as an independent, and C, why it would be a good thing. It's not something you can do in 5 or 10 minutes.
What's the feedback you've been getting as you've been knocking on doors in the Craig Cannonier's constituency?
Well, I've been having discussions, open and honest discussions, with people who I think know me and I know them. And I would prefer not to betray their... I've talked about the general things that are on their mind, but I prefer not to betray their confidence in me and talk about specific things that people...
Fine,
people
but have you been positively received?
Well, yes. I would say...
More than negatively?
Yes. But that's... You see, here's the thing, you have to recognize this, that, as I said, there was one sort of view before the election was called.
Yes.
The election got closer, people changed their views or start to modify or to think a little harder, and that's what I'm tracking right now. And I think that people are, you know, wondering, well, okay, are there going to be other independents? Is it going to be a good thing? How's it going to work out? Am I going to be assisting the wrong party in their view as opposed to the right one? And these are all factors that I think cause people to think twice. And it's important that I recognize that and track it. I mean,
I believe it's till July the 4th to register.
That's the final date. Well, I'll have to obviously make a decision by then. But the other thing I think about sometimes is that... As someone told me yesterday, another conversation I'm having about independence, not just myself but others running, this was one person who was a potential one who's decided not to, reminded me that sometimes, and Bermuda's history has certainly been like this, some of the greatest influence for change, some of the greatest changes occurred in Bermuda, not from within the House of Assembly but from outside the House of Assembly. So there is great opportunity and a lot to be said sometimes for not engaging in the actual theater of politics, but trying to influence it from the outside, it's a harder job. But when that coalescing occurs, it can have.
It's interesting you say that, because in the column I wrote, that I said I'm right on the edge of the political periphery. I mean, I'm almost falling off the end of the world in that respect. But even I'm picking up a sense that there are a lot of people who want to stand as independents. Could that message alone get through to government and help whichever one it is, PLP or OBA?
No, as I told you before, what really matters, and that's why I say the Caymans a good example of this, is what politicians invariably listen to and follow quite closely is power and the loss of power. That's the most instructive message you can have to a political party. And that's what's going on, say, in Washington now, you know, with the Democrats having lost the White House as they did, and what they've got.
And the recent congressional election.
That's right, and what they've had as a result. They're thinking that, you know, we really, there's something wrong with our not only our messaging, but our messengers. And that's when it starts to happen. That is very instructive, loss of power.
You've touched on it many times, and you've basically answered the question. I think you're still deliberating. How tempted are you to stand as an independent? How tempted are you?
Very.
So?
Very, very. I was very tempted. I was very encouraged.
Are you still very tempted?
As I told you, I'm still working through this as to A, whether it's a viable way to go, B, whether it's the best way for me to go and for what I'd like to see achieved. Because honestly, I'm telling you here and now, that I want to try and change the political culture, the political dynamic in this country. That's my real goal.
That was easier to hear on the inside.
You'd think so, but remember, I was a founding member of the OBA, and I thought that this was going to happen. And we talked about what has and hasn't happened since they've been elected, and it didn't seem to bear fruit in terms of changing the way in which business was going to be conducted. If you go back and look at the manifesto when it came to matters of good governance. And I don't know that inside is the only way to achieve it. You need to have a critical mass of people, I think, outside the political structure who bring that weight and influence to bear on a party and on a party that's in power. One that seeks power, of course, and one that's in power, so that these changes start to occur. Now, that's not to say that the system is, at the end of the day, people are what make the system work. There's no question about it. And what I think, and what I've always tried to do in my political and public life, is not to use too strong adjectives, one that start to go over the top, that invite, that encourage, sort of attack back. And if there's one thought I'd like to leave, you know, you and the listeners with today, is that it strikes me as, and it's from a Persian poet whose name I can't remember, and it goes like this: enhance your words, lower your voice. Rain makes the flowers grow, not thunder. And that's absolutely right. And for a place as small as Bermuda, we need to get that type of culture, that type of relationship into our political arena, into our public life for others to follow. Because when I hear and we see what goes on in gangs, I mean, there's not a complete disconnect, I don't think, between what goes on up there and what is going on down there. And I'm not saying one models the other.
No, clearly.
But it's human nature, arguably not at its best. I'm not saying at its worst, but not at its best. And we have to do things that draw out the best in us rather than the worst in us.
On that note, Mr. Barrett, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for tuning in to Burr News Current Affairs Podcast with Jeremy Deacon. Listen at your leisure on www.burrnews.com, your 24/7 Bermuda news source.